I'm Abby Kinney, and you are listening to Upzoned. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to another episode of Upzoned, a weekly in-depth conversation that covers one big story in the news that touches the Strong Towns conversation. I'm Abby Kinney, planner at Gould Evans, working out of the Kansas City office, which nowadays happens to be my home. I have stopped keeping track of how many weeks we've been working from home now, and I'm kind of just starting to appreciate the benefits that come with being at home more and being more present in my neighborhood. I'm thankful that I have the ability to work right now because so many people just don't. Joined with me this week is our regular co-host and founder of Strong Towns, Chuck Marone. Thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Abby. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Of course. So today's article that we're going to discuss is published by Sabrina Tavernisi and Sarah Mervosh of the New York Times, called America's Biggest Cities Were Already Losing Their Allure, What Happens Next? As the title alludes to, the article illustrates why many major cities in the United States, like New York, LA, Chicago, they had already been losing their allure for many people, the primary reason being the cost of living. Studies over the last 5 to 10 years have been pointing to the slowed rate of population growth in these places as people have either been discouraged from relocating to expensive cities or have been forced out by the cost of living. As some residents retreat from these big cities to stay with families or at their vacation homes in more remote areas during the coronavirus crisis, the article considers whether these residents will return once the stay-at-home orders are lifted. This article was actually covered by Joe Courtwright of City Observatory in a story that was recently run by Strong Towns, but I think it's an interesting and complicated topic that warrants further discussion.
Absolutely. Right off the bat, I think there's an important distinction to make here, and it's the Yogi Berra-ism, the place that nobody goes there anymore because it's so busy. There's a bunch of different reasons why housing prices were so unaffordable in major cities. One of those reasons is because a lot of people wanted to be there. And so there is kind of an irony or a dichotomy that we saw some of the vitality in some metrics starting to slip out of some of these places because they were becoming havens for the very rich and professional class, and a lot of other people were being squeezed out. I want to acknowledge that because I know there's people listening here now, and I hear this all the time. They're like, you know, well, cities are losing their luster. And you'll say San Francisco and New York, and they'll say, what? It's never been a better time to be in San Francisco. Like New York, everyone wants to live here. And that's very true amongst like a group of people, but there's a growing swath of people who find it unaffordable and find the trade-offs of that affordability equation to be not worth the benefit that you get from living in that place. I feel like that's the premise of the cities were already losing their allure, right?
Exactly. There's a legitimate argument to be made that concerns about contagion may intensify the trend of people moving out of larger cities simply because the already high cost of housing may no longer be tolerable to the people who could basically maybe not even afford to live in these places in the first place. However, I don't think that this points necessarily to the diminishing allure of major cities. This trend was fundamentally caused by the undersupply of housing. As Joe countered in the article that was published in Strong Towns, the relationship between urban centers and the surrounding suburbs in major cities is fundamentally tied to the supply of housing and the locational value of the places where opportunities exist. As development of new housing is severely limited while the demand is increasing, the housing costs are naturally going to go up. And as the cost of living goes up, many people are going to find that it's just not worth it to stay in these places, or they're pushed out unwillingly. And, you know, in extreme market conditions that we see in New York, it would make sense that we'd see the growth of suburbs as the demand for more affordable housing pushes outwards. And I don't think this is necessarily tied to the quote unquote allure or fascination people have with cities, but rather just an outcome of people making rational decisions about where they live based on the cost of housing and the trade-offs that come with location.
Right. See, I've always taken a little bit of issue with the simple narrative that this is a supply-demand problem. And I know that's drawn the ire of like market urbanists and other people, the YIMBYs who are just like, you know, build until we drive down the price, saturate the demand and drive down the price. I've always found that simplistic because it seems to me like there's at least two other components that are driving this besides the supply-demand, which is a function of government regulation and people wanting to be there and how quickly developers can build and all that. Those two things are the financialization of housing, the fact that we literally have pumped trillions of dollars into the economy to keep things going. And the way that that has manifested is in the appreciation, the artificial appreciation of desirable properties in desirable places. And so, you know, what is that premium? Is it 5%? Is it 10%? I've seen things that have said it's as high as 80% in some major cities of the price of a house is due to financialization. The other part of it, the other thing that's driven up prices in these places is, I'm going to say it like this, and I don't think this is exact. There's a technical term for it, and I don't know what it is, but it's like the belief that housing prices will go up. This is almost universal in these places. When I talk to people about housing, there's a kind of universal belief, even today in the middle of this pandemic, that housing prices next year will be higher than they are today in New York, in San Francisco, in Chicago, in the most desirable urban neighborhoods in major U.S. cities. And that belief becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? If I believe it, I will pay higher for it because I believe it's going to be higher next year. And with all financial bubbles, which I think the financialization part and the belief part have played a huge role in, you take the stairs on the way up and you take the elevator on the way down. And so I think that there is yet to be seen a year from now if you will still have, you know, if our attempts to revive the economy will just simply result in more housing inflation, or if we will actually see a collapse down to what true market value would be. And then I think, you know, you've got the opposite, which is the allure of cities, you know, maybe we'll be there, maybe not, but it won't be tied to housing affordability.
Well, with a new situation like this, it's really easy to jump to judgments, namely in cities and in the idea that urbanism is riskier because of the threat of infections. The New York Times article rightly points out that there are just too many moving parts to really understand how the crisis is going to impact the way people live. The outcome of shifts in remote working or retail and residential real estate, immigration, I think they mention the non-vital employment sectors that are now unemployed right now. Those are all factors that are going to play a role in what happens in these major cities as well as mid-sized cities. Whether or not people will actually decide to come back to New York, I have a hard time believing that this type of situation is going to deter people from living there, but it may make people think twice about having like a vacation home there or deciding that they want to reside there permanently, which I know that could bring the prices down back to kind of maybe a normal level.
Well, I've seen a lot of people out talking their book in a sense. So you got like the Joel Kotkins and the Randall O'Tooles of the world who are out saying like, hey, this is like going to be a renaissance for suburbs now because no one's going to want to live in a city. They're dirty, they're nasty, they're full of disease, and people are going to want to live in the suburbs. And I find that to be an absurdity for a couple reasons. First, the suburbs is nothing but like, it's like clustering of pods. So you're actually, I think in many ways, more likely to have infection and have infection spread broadly in a suburb than a city. Not necessarily sitting in your home, but in the fact that suburbs force everyone to go to the same place at the same time for basic essentials. You know,
exactly.
In an urban neighborhood, you've got 100 different corner grocery stores. In, you know, the suburb where my brother lives, you have one grocery store. Everybody goes there. you have one big get together place. You have one big park. You have the nature of the suburbs is designed for like spatial efficiency. And so, you know, you cluster everything in one place and then you require everyone to drive to that one place. The other thing about the suburbs that just, I think none of these models are really, or none of these prognosticators are taking into account is the fact that every single suburb now is going to be totally broke. And I mean, we've talked about for a decade now or more about how cities are insolvent and how cities have more liabilities and more long-term promises than they have wealth and wealth potential to pay for those promises. That's always been like a looming condition. Your belt has to be tightened. You're taking on more debt. You're raising taxes. But like you didn't meet a point where you're like, okay, now this is like we're in massive fiscal distress. When cities wake up from this, they are going to be in massive fiscal distress, almost every single one. And so all of that like out in the future is now going to be now. And the worst ones, the ones that are in the most fiscal distress will be the suburbs. They have the least productive development pattern. They have the most long-term liabilities and they have the lowest amount of capacity to adapt to changing circumstances.
Well, and especially the aging suburbs where, you know, a lot of buildings are kind of reaching the end of their useful life, especially on the commercial side of things. The article discusses the fact that New York City is going to be facing major budget shortfalls, which could discourage people from returning. But we actually discussed this topic last week, and it's important to underscore that no municipality is going to be exempt from budget shortfalls caused by a decline in income and sales tax and even property tax potentially. This reality is just not limited to major cities. As we discussed last week, property taxes are more stable, but many cities will not cover what is demanded by the residents. In addition to that point, sprawl, or, you know, for lack of a better word, is incredibly expensive. Strong Towns has made the case over the years that communities with inefficient development patterns that disregard our fundamental need for proximity will have long-term financial issues when infrastructure grows old. So the existence of a new virus does not necessarily change the fiscal realities related to our settlement patterns and everything it demands. Given the way that we are beginning to understand financial impacts of overbuilding public infrastructure, personally, I'm skeptical that it would be in the best interest of any city to once again hollow out the urban core and build new long-term liabilities on the outskirts of town. But then again, nothing surprises me anymore. The outcomes of this and how it gets handled will have some distinctions based on what state you're in, but moving from New York City to another city is not going to escape the lack of public resources. In fact, large cities are the candidates that are most likely to get federal support of some sort.
Right. I think it's fascinating because if we look at New York, or I mean, let's look at Kansas City where you're at. If you go to New York, there are a bizarre number of square feet that are dedicated to parking and storing vehicles. And it would maybe shock many people to know that when you go in to get a permit for building a new building or renovating a building in New York City, you are subjected to the same insane kind of parking requirements that you see in cities like Kansas City or cities like mine here in central Minnesota. One of our board members, Ian Rasmussen, works with people all the time who are trying to, you know, restore some sanity to the permitting process. He's an attorney and he helps prepare maps and presentations for people who are going in front of the planning board there in New York. And he said the number one issue is parking. And the planners all require it. And it's absurd because no one in any of these neighborhoods needs to have a car. You look at that fact and you look at where we're at today. And I think the creeping realization that people living in cities have that they're actually better off. And I'm going to say this, I'm not making this a personal thing. So I don't want anybody listening here to take this personally one way or the other. This is not like a human thing. I think people in cities are realizing that they're actually better off without the commuters. You know, like without the highway through the middle of their neighborhood, without all the traffic, without all the people driving in, which we've been told for years, whether it's in New York or in Kansas City or here in little old Brainerd, that without all those people, you know, those generous, benevolent people out on the edge, all the rich people, without them driving in and spending their money here and going to offices here and taking part in our community here, we couldn't do anything. We would be destitute without them. Well, the reality is the exact opposite. Once you take them away, we like step back and go, wow, it's pretty nice to live here. And we really don't need them. And there's a whole lot we can do without them. And when you grasp the economics of how this works, you realize that it's merely a transfer from the inner core neighborhoods financially to the outskirts of town. You're like, why are we doing this again? I think that if anything, there will be a renaissance, particularly once you get beyond those places that are really financially distorted. You know, the place where you have the hedge funds buying up entire places like New York and San Francisco and Vancouver and what have you. When you get to a place like Kansas City, I think there will be a huge renaissance of people who now recognize that the core of the city and those core neighborhoods is where I can have the highest quality of life at the most affordable price.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And something that I think Kansas City should be very proud of is the fact that they've been able to build up an actual community of people who are living in the downtown and the urban core areas, the pre-1950s development context and neighborhoods of Kansas City. There's families, there's young people, there's old people, like everybody is operating right now as a community. And it's something that I've come to really appreciate. And it's nice without all the traffic. And it's nice to be able to walk and ride my bike and, you know, not have to deal with rush hour traffic driving by and blocking up intersections. I kind of wonder if there would be a renaissance for people who are interested in living in just simply walkable, traditional style neighborhoods. I know that I think the New York Times article mentioned that's already a trend that's been happening. It's not necessarily one way or the other. I think a lot of people talk about density, and the relationship between density and contagion is certainly a worthwhile discussion. However, these distinctions, I think, often overlook the fact that proximity to other people is number one fundamental to how we, you know, build cities and afford all the things that we need. But this newfound concern about coronavirus may impact the demand for people wanting to live in high rises. But these discussions around density present sort of this false dichotomy that we only have two options, which is living in a high rise or living in an exurban subdivision that we already know doesn't produce enough stable public wealth to sustain itself. This false dichotomy to me seems to be rooted in America's like dysfunctional relationship that we have with cities and our underlying lack of understanding with what density even means.
You take a nice block in Charlotte where you have hundreds of people living, many, many different units, many different doors and entryways, in and out, sidewalks, the whole thing. And you take that same level of density and you put it into one like Texas donut type condo unit where everybody comes in and out of one door and, you know, everybody has to congregate through the lobby. There's a very different, if we're talking like livability, tax base, go through all the pre-pandemic metrics, there's a huge advantage for the Charleston style block, that mixed use, you know, fabric. But if you look at it from a pandemic standpoint, you look at it from a viral spread, the problem is not dense or not dense, because both of those are extremely dense. The problem is the concentration that the design forces us into. And that is a reality, whether you're talking about suburban style development or, you know, the suburban style development that's been brought into cities and now is called urbanism, you're talking about the same exact type of downfall.
Exactly. And it's all about scaling up and essentially consolidating any amenities or just, you know, essential functions of a development so that, yeah, if you're in one of those big block apartment buildings, then your risk of contagion is probably higher than living in the same density, but a totally different context. My neighborhood is relatively dense. All the houses are pretty close together. We have various different housing types. But that doesn't necessarily mean that I'm any less safe. I'm able to, you know, walk out my front door. I'm able to go to the small park that the, you know, people in the neighborhood are mostly just using. And we have a grocery store less than a mile away. So I think that there's a lot that gets missed when we're talking about density, or what does urban mean? What does it, what does a city or an urban core mean to people? It's, those discussions often get so simplified that we don't think about the context of living arrangements that are traditional neighborhoods and walkable places. And for those who aren't aware of what the distinction is, traditional neighborhoods are essentially predominantly residential communities that are designed with interconnected streets and small blocks and a diverse range of housing types. Many of America's streetcar suburbs are actually, that could be considered a traditional neighborhood development pattern. And these neighborhoods are denser than conventional subdivision contexts, but they don't contain high-rise buildings necessarily. Instead, they contain more variety, which is something that we always say is important, that neighborhoods diversify as much as possible, especially neighborhoods that are concerned about issues of affordability and cost of housing. And many studies have stated that there is a growing demand for living in walkable neighborhoods, and I don't see that slowing down anytime soon.
No, not at all. And let's be very clear, because I think there's a natural reaction amongst city advocates to just push back on the density, the Joel Kotkin, Randall O'Toole, oh, cities are just like big petri dish germ factories. And the urbanists are saying like, no, there's no correlation at all. There is a correlation. And let's just be very clear about the history of this. If we went back 200 years and looked at cities, if you were a human being 200 years ago, you had two options. Option number one was you live in the rural countryside. You live on a farm, or you work on a farm, or you work in some type of agricultural, mining, logging, hunting, you know, some type of very individual pursuit that is a couple steps above subsistence living. Or you live in a city. And cities at that time had poor sanitation, poor health, lots of disease. Thomas Jefferson famously wrote about how awful and terrible cities were, and how he, you know, could just like couldn't wait to escape the bad air and the stench and what have you. The whole city beautiful movement in the early 20th century was designed to counteract the historic problems of cities. Let's have good sewer systems. Let's have good water systems. Let's open up some public spaces and create some parks and create some statues and make things look good. You know, let's bring some elements of livability into cities. And so the idea that we would fast forward to today, after we've had 70 plus years of essentially suburbanizing urban areas, you know, building these like vertical suburbs and then surrounding them by auto infrastructure designed to, you know, in a sense, separate things and make them denuded in a lot of ways, we have gotten away from the ideas of the City Beautiful movement, the ideas of the early 20th century of taking the city and making it a wonderful place to be. In the parts of the country where you see they've actually gone back to that pursuit, and I think New York is a prime example of this. I think there are parts of your city in Kansas City where they've gone back and actually tried to restore some of this and pick up where they left off, in a sense, 100 years ago. Those neighborhoods are spectacular, and they're wonderful places to live, and they have all the benefits of a city, but without all the downside. That's really what we're trying to get to. It's really not right, like, to look at, I look at Minneapolis here as the one that I interact with the most and see the best. And people are pointing to like the Cedar Riverside neighborhood, which is the urban renewal projects, and saying like, look, you know, just ground zero for what a pandemic would just run through a population like this. And the answer is like, yes, that is very true. That's really not what a city is or was designed to be. That is a part of the suburban experiment. And a part of, you know, this whole like top-down way to construct human habitat that didn't work. And we're advocating for like a bottom-up approach that is much more organic, much more human, and really in terms of a pandemic, much more beneficial than anything that we built, whether you're going to call it suburbs or urban.
I think that's a really good point. And you know what? We are running a little bit over time today. I think that's okay.
Imagine that. I think we've had a tendency to do that now.
Well, you know what? They're interesting conversations. So I think it's okay to run a little bit over time. It's stuff that I could honestly talk about all day. But now we're going to move into the down zone, the part of this show where we talk about anything that we've been watching or reading or listening to, or just anything that's interesting that's happening in our life. So Chuck, do you have anything for this week?
Well, last weekend I got to work in the yard and I listened to a John Sanford book, a fiction book. I usually reserve all my fiction for Christmas time, for December. And I was like, no, I just need some now. I need to get my mind off things. And that was kind of fun. Sanford writes these detective cop police drama books, and they're based in Minnesota. The characters are based in Minnesota, and they're kind of fun. But I had this book recommended to me by a colleague. It's called The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America by Orrin Cass. And it's basically a conservative-oriented defense of unions and laborers and workers that is very far from populist rhetoric, but very grounded in what it means to be a human and live a fulfilling life. So I've just gotten like maybe a fourth into it, and I've found it to be very delightful.
Well, that sounds really interesting. This week, I actually don't have any media to share, but just the fact that we've been spending a lot of our time doing a little something called morel mushroom hunting. Do you guys do that up in Minnesota?
I know there are people that do. See, I am of the very picky eater variety. I think one of the things that people are most surprised about when they, you know, interpose their own beliefs on what they think I am is that I'm like a terrible eater. I eat like four different foods and they're all bad for you. And I'm just not. So mushrooms is not part of my, like, I know people who do that. And I'm like, I would never do that because I just don't like mushrooms. But I've heard of people who do this.
So I'll tell you what, I personally don't like eating morel mushrooms, but my husband really likes eating them. And I love walking around in the woods and looking for them. I find it to be really rewarding. And it's like the one place I can take my dog and like she'll follow me around and I don't necessarily have to have her on a leash. We can just go like deep, deep into the woods.
Right.
So yeah, that's been really nice. It's very quiet and peaceful and fun to just look for them. And I'm trying to train my dog to like help me sniff them out because they have a specific smell. And, you know, I'm hoping that I could get my dog to help me out a little bit, because when you don't know exactly where to look for them, they're very hard to find if you're in a new place.
Sure. I know people who like them really love that. And I'll put you on the spot now. I know I recommended Sherlock to you a while back. Did you have an opportunity to watch any of those or not yet?
No, not yet. We actually have not been watching very much TV at all lately. It's been pretty nice out. And so we've spent a lot of time just being outside, and basically any time I'm not working, we're either going on bike rides or looking for morels. Just trying to get out of the house so that I don't go stir crazy.
Well, put that on your list. The next time you find yourself sitting on the couch and cruising around, watch it. I'm interested because my working hours tend to be late at night. Sometimes if I'm doing like mindless work, stuff I don't need to focus on, I will turn on a show. And I started watching Sherlock again, like from beginning to end. And I was thinking about you. I was thinking, well, I wonder if Abby's watched these. I would like to hear how she likes them. Because they are so very good.
I'll be sure to do that because I need a new show now that, you know, Ozark is done and I haven't really been able to pick anything else up since then. So I kind of need to start something at least to occupy my time.
Well, they're very smart, and that's why I think you would like them. I mean, I think like you're a smart person, and I think like you would get like the wittiness of these would really, I think, you know, fit well with the way you think about things. So give it a try.
Awesome. Well, thanks for reminding me of the recommendation. I think that concludes today's episode. Thank you all for listening, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town. Let me show you what I'm about to do. I'm about to get out. Hit the town tonight. Oh, we're about to get down tonight. Hit the town tonight. Oh, we're about to get down tonight. Get out. Hit the town tonight. Oh, we're about to get down tonight.